God, the Author of All, Part 1, the sixth talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 8, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The handout to which Dr. Crabtree refers in this talk is handout number 5 in this series.
Well, for some time now, I've been alternating between two different series. The series I'm taking a hiatus from is the one on the reliability of the Bible, whether the Bible is reliable, and I'm responding to a book by Bart Ehrman. I'm going to stop that, cut that off right now. I'll come back to it again later, but I want to return to the initial series, the biblical philosophy, the message and worldview of the Bible, subtitle Why Jesus Would Not Be a Christian. And the thesis of that series is that that the message that Christianity brings to the world is not really the same as the message that God brought to the world through his son Jesus. So Jesus would not embrace the message that Christian culture and Christian history and Christian traditions announced to the world as the Christian faith. It's really not the same thing. And even more importantly, the worldview that Christianity proposes to the world is not the same worldview that Jesus would embrace. And that's the thesis of this whole series. In the first several weeks, we looked at the doctrine of the Trinity, and I argued that the idea that God is an eternal triune being, a God who has one essence and three persons, is not really a biblical idea, but it's a synthesis of Greek philosophical speculation and some biblical language and biblical ideas, but it's not really the perspective of the Bible itself. We took quite a bit of time on that. I'm going to leave that behind. All I will say is that at the end of February, we will be having a conference. I will be along with a group of other people where we will actually look at the passages and try to make the case biblically for or show biblically that there is a better way of looking at the concept of God in the Bible than the Trinity. So that'll be coming up at the end of February. The way I am approaching this is, if you will remember, I concocted an artificial ordinary Christian's creed, and I'm going through this creed one by one. The first tenet of the creed was, before the beginning of created reality, there was God, an eternally triune being, and that's the one I talked about for about 4 weeks late last fall. Today I'd like to go on to the next one, to the next statement on the creed. From nothing, God gave existence to everything that makes up the cosmos so that the cosmos could now exist right alongside himself. That's the tenet that I want to take up. To do that, and I want to say in advance, this is probably the most important concept of this entire series, because if I'm wrong about what I'm saying here, then I'm probably wrong about everything I'm saying everywhere. This is sort of foundational to what I now grasp to be the biblical worldview. So this is a critical issue. What's the relationship between the Creator, God, and his creation? Understanding that relationship, so much in our understanding of the Bible is going to hinge on how we understand that. And my basic contention is Christianity has got God wrong. Christianity has got the relationship between the Creator and the creation just wrong. And because they've gotten that wrong, there's so many other things that follow in its wake that it has gotten wrong as well. So what's at issue is Genesis 1:1. And if you're looking along in the handout, if you printed that out, this is my first point on the handout. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Simple statement. One would think that there's nothing to talk about there. There's God, and he created the heavens and the earth. But the problem is, we can have radically different pictures, and let me underline the word pictures, or models, which really reflect different concepts of what it means for God to create something and God to be the creator of reality. On the one hand, we could think of God as a sort of craftsman. A craftsman takes materials available to him. A woodworker takes wood, saws it, hammers it, carves it, whittles it, whatever else woodworkers do, burn it, scorch it, etch it, and make whatever it is they're going to make out of wood. The wood's already available to them, and they use their skill as an artisan to make something out of that. That is the classical view of creation within polytheism, within paganism, within the pagan polytheism that pervaded the ancient world. Their concept of their gods as creators is that they took something that already existed and fashioned out of that the world. In the Akkadian creation myth, Marduk, the junior god, kills the senior gods, Tiamat and Apsu, and out of their corpses, or I guess it's only one of them, out of the corpse of one of them, cutting it in half, he fashions the heavens and the earth. And from the blood of Tiamat, he forms human beings. So he's not creating out of nothing. He's simply fashioning the heavens and the earth and everything in it out of material that already exists. Where did that come from? They don't give an answer to that. Just was just there. You're not going to find too many Christians who have that concept of God, because Christianity, I think, is pretty clear that God is the creator of the world out of nothing. He didn't use anything, any pre-existing material to make the world. He just made it out of nothing. So that's not really a very viable candidate for how we should understand Genesis 1:1. Although I will say there are scholars who have taken Genesis 1:1 to not be creation out of nothing. And I don't agree with them. I think they're wrong. I'm not even sure what they're thinking exactly. But I think they're influenced by the fact that they just assume that this must be influenced by the pagan polytheistic creation myths, and therefore we are to read this the same way they read them. I don't think that's right. I think this is a radically different conception of the world than existed in ancient polytheism. There's a second picture that we can have, and that is to think of God more like a wizard. So think Harry Potter, although I may get in trouble because I don't know what I'm talking about because I haven't read Harry Potter, but I saw one movie, so... But what does a wizard do? A wizard is actually taking pre-existing materials as well. It's just that they are invisible, immaterial, back behind the scenes, not tangible, not concrete, and therefore not manifest and not obvious. But what we're thinking when we think in terms of magic is that there are deeper structures to reality than meet the eye. And the wizard is the one who can get in touch with those and manipulate those and can manage to use the forces that exist in the deeper structures of reality to make things manifest that otherwise would not be manifest to us. I would argue that this is the concept of God as creator that I grew up with in Christianity, and I think is probably the typical view that most Christians have. So Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. How did he do that? He spoke it into existence. Let there be light, and there was light. How did he do that? Well, he's a wizard. It's magic. He had powers that the rest of us don't have. You and I can't speak things into existence, but God, who knows the depths of reality, But notice, if he knows the depths of reality, he knows the depths of a reality that's already there and exists alongside of him and is concurrent with him. Knowing that reality, he is able to, he has the skill and the knowledge and the wisdom to be able to bring the powers that exist to bear on his purposes and make manifest that which would not otherwise be manifest. Now, I say a lot, I say most Christians believe that. I don't think they know that they believe that. Because if you ask them, well, did something exist alongside God at the same time that he did? No. And yet, I would submit their mental picture of how it is that God is bringing the world into being is exactly that of a wizard speaking reality into being. And I'll talk about the implications of that here as we go. Another one, much less common, but you might find shades of this within Christianity, is God as mother or father, as the progenitor of reality. He gives birth to reality out of his own being. He gives birth to reality. A more common form of that is not creation at all. And this is actually very common in the history of Christianity, completely contrary to the very notion of creation. But in a pagan philosophy called Neoplatonism, the idea was that God, the ultimate being, was just so chock full of being that he couldn't help but spill over. So think of it as this fountain overflowing, and water being existence, being reality, being. He was so full of reality and being that it spilled over, and the drops of water falling away from the fountain, that's what became the created reality. The angels, all the superior, I won't get into the technicalities of it, but you finally, is when you get about as far away from being as you can get, you get the world and us. We are barely real in Neoplatonism. Well, that had a tremendous influence on the history of Christian thought, and there are many Christians who were basically in Neoplatonists. God was the most real being. God was that being who was so full of being that he couldn't help himself, and he spilled over, and out of his spillage comes what we think of as the created cosmos. Now, that's not an act of creation. That's an act of, I don't know what that is, but I mean, we are one and the same. We are a part of God in that view. But it wouldn't take much tweaking to turn that into an act of creation, and yet nonetheless never abandon that picture, never abandon that model. Well, that's not too much unlike him giving birth to the universe, in the sense that what's the relationship between the creator and the creation? The creation shares the same being as God. The created order just is a part of God extending itself. Then there's a fourth picture, and my contention is this is the one, I think, that matches how the Bible is looking at God's relationship through the creation. To think of God as the author. Just as an author is to the works of his imagination, say a novelist writing a novel, for example, the author, the novelist, imagines a whole world and all the characters in it and all the events in it and the whole storyline and plot line and everything about it is the product of his imagination, his mind. My contention is going to be that what we are intended to understand in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, is God speaking created reality into existence as a author brings it into an existence. Not as an artisan, not as a parent, not as a wizard, not in any other way except as an author. Some of you know that's my whole contention in the book I wrote called The Most Real Being. So a more ambitious and difficult and inaccessible approach to that can be found in that book. So, as I was suggesting, which of those pictures we take is critical, because it's going to be foundational to all the rest of our theology. I'll come back to that in a second. But I want to answer first an objection. And the objection that might frequently come my way would be, Jack, you need to stick to the Bible. Don't do philosophy and bring your philosophical beliefs into it. Just stick to the Bible, pure and simple. The problem is that that's a fundamentally naive objection, because the reality is everyone will and everyone must bring his or her philosophical beliefs into their interpretation of a biblical text, for example, Genesis 1:1. You can't leave philosophy aside. To leave philosophy aside is to not come up with any interpretation of Genesis 1:1. It's not to come up with a strictly biblical one. It's to come up with nothing. Because you have to ask yourself the question, what does it mean to create? And the minute you ask the question, what does it mean to create, you're going to have to answer it in order to interpret the verse. And unless the Bible has a verse that says, when I say create, I mean, then you're going to have to answer that question extra-biblically, outside of the biblical text and aside from the biblical text. You're going to have to bring that with you. So when I argue that God saying, let there be light and there is light, is like an author creating a book, I have just as much right to answer that question as Orthodoxy does when they answer that question, however they answer that question. They too are bringing a certain set of philosophical assumptions into their reading of the verse. They're either right or they're wrong. I'm either right or I'm wrong. But it's not like I don't have any business thinking about what it means. I have to do that. How can I not do that? The reason it looks like I'm doing something extra is because there's two kinds of philosophical assumptions: those you've thought about and those you've absorbed from your culture. They're both a set of philosophical assumptions, but most of us, you know, we drink in our philosophy like we drink in our mother's milk. It just becomes a part of us because we swim in the sea of ideas, and it makes us who we are, and it makes our mind function the way our mind functions. So to us, if we never challenge those assumptions that our culture has given to us, it looks to us like we're not doing philosophy, we're just interpreting. But the fact of the matter is, you are doing philosophy, you just haven't thought about the philosophy that you're doing. You haven't reflected on it, you haven't articulated it to yourself, you haven't become aware and conscious of it. But are you doing philosophy? Are you assuming a certain set of basic fundamental principles? Absolutely. And my being trained as a philosopher, one of the things that we do as an occupation is stop to park on our ideas long enough to actually think about them and analyze them. I believe this. Why do I believe this? I believe this. Should I believe this? Or should I believe in something else? And my contention is that of all the people in America today who ought to be philosophers, it's believers. Believers in Jesus. That we are not afraid to think, we are not ashamed to think, and we are committed to learning to think about what it is we believe and to be willing to defend it and abandon it if it cannot be defended. We of all people should not be afraid of truth, wherever it might lead us. So that's, I think, what we need to do when it comes to God. We shouldn't be afraid of thinking new ideas and having new pictures and having new models if, in fact, they are more warranted than the one that I have always believed for decades because I was a Christian. philosophical assumptions are just as much, are just as important and play as the same kind of role in exegesis as cultural background. I remember as a child just reading Jesus' comment, whatever is whispered in the inner rooms will be shouted on the housetops. The only picture I could muster of that is somebody straddling the apex of a roof, teetering there precariously, saying, you'll never guess what Jack said. You know? A bizarre, bizarre image, and has nothing to do with what Jesus meant. Because he wasn't speaking in and to a culture that had peaked roofs. He was speaking within and to a culture that had flat roofs that functioned as another room of the house, that functioned as the area where you socialize. When you have your neighbor over on a warm Palestinian evening, you retire to the roof, to the rooftop, and you sit around and you have a conversation. So basically what Jesus is saying is, what you think you have kept secret from your neighbors and your social context, it's the buzz of the town. It will become the buzz of the town. Everybody will be talking about it. A very profound point about human interaction and human delusion. We think that we can keep our evil secret. We think that we can keep our moral failings only known to us. And what he's saying is, it's futile. Even if you try, it ain't going to work. Everybody is going to know, and everyone is going to be talking about how much you lack integrity, how much you are a liar, how much you are a fraud, how much you are a cheat, or whatever it is you are. You will not keep it secret. And his whole point is, why do hypocrisy? It doesn't work. The one who pretends like he's righteous, everybody's ultimately going to see through it. So why don't you just cut that short and just start being honest? Admit that you're evil along with all of your neighbors. Admit together that we are what we are and stop trying to pretend otherwise. Well, I wouldn't understand that that's Jesus' point if I didn't import into my exegesis of that the appropriate cultural background. By the same token, I'm not going to understand any assertion that the biblical text makes unless I import into it the right set of philosophical assumptions to go with it. If I import the wrong set of philosophical assumptions, I'm going to get my exegesis wrong. I'm not going to know what that biblical assertion means. So that's what I'm proposing for Genesis 1, is that the right set of philosophical assumptions includes a picture, a model, an understanding of God's relationship to the creation as the author of some story is to the story that he is creating. Let me go just a little further, and then I'll open it up for any reaction that you have. Now, what are the ramifications of this? What if God is a builder or a craftsman? If God is a builder or a craftsman, as in ancient polytheism, then God's creation and God exist on the same level. They're on the same level of being. If a woodworker builds a chair, that chair exists on the same level as he, the builder. The builder can turn around and sit on the chair, or bang his shin against the chair, or pick up the chair and smash the table he made with it. I mean, there's any number of things that he can interact with that chair as if that chair were at the same level of reality and being as he is. So similarly, if God built the universe, then the created universe exists on the same level as God. And what I'm going to argue to those of you who might be inclined to object, no, Christians don't believe in those other models that you're talking about, Jack. My contention would be, listen to them. They will over and over and over again say things that imply that they think the creation exists on the same level of reality as God does, or vice versa, God exists on the same level of reality as the creation. Anytime you think God exists on the same level as his creation, you're not working with the author model. You're working with one of these other pictures. Because the same thing is true of a wizard. If I wave my magic wand and conjure up a dragon, I might be scorched by the dragon's fiery breath, right? I think so. I mean, you Harry Potter aficionados, am I wrong? I think the dragon could actually kill you, the wizard, even though you are the one who conjured it up. Why? Because it exists on the same plane of reality that you do. And you exist on the same plane of reality as the dragon. The product of your wizardry is no less real than you are. You are no more real than the product of your wizardry. Same thing is true of being the progenitor or the parent. If God gives birth to the universe, he's giving birth to something that is just as real as he is. A mother or father could be killed by their own children. That bringing them into existence can impinge upon their lives and their being. Every model of creation except one puts the created order on the same level of existence as the creator. The only model that sees the creator as on another level of existence is the author model. If I'm in the middle of writing a novel, I don't lock my door at night afraid that that character is going to come back and get me. And why do I not feel threatened at all by the characters I'm creating in the novel? Because they don't even live on my plane of existence. They don't even exist on my plane of existence. They couldn't possibly impinge on my life. It's a very asymmetrical relationship. Everything about them is under my control, and nothing about my existence could be at all controlled or even affected or influenced by them. That's the only model that sees that kind of asymmetry between the creation and the creator. And that's my contention is everything else in the Bible requires that kind of asymmetry. And that's why that would be my argument for why the author model captures the God of the biblical worldview in a way that none of these other models do. So as a critique, of the statement in the creed that I concocted. From nothing, God gave existence to everything that makes up the cosmos so that the cosmos could now exist right alongside himself. To phrase it that way is to make explicit that I'm thinking in terms of a model of God as creator where whatever his relationship to the creation, whether he's the artisan or the wizard or the parent, It's a model that thinks that the world came into existence alongside of him on the same level of reality, on the same plane of existence. And that's what I'm rejecting. I think that's fundamentally false and fundamentally out of sync with everything that underlies what the Bible says. So let me pause there for a second for your comments or questions before I go on.
Thanks, Jack. So to reflect to make sure I'm getting the concept right, do I understand you saying that ultimately we are all philosophers and many of us are unconscious of our philosophy, therefore are subject to it and being with its blinders, and some of us, most of us are unconscious philosophers, and therefore are carried away by our philosophy without having actually wrestled with it,
right?
As opposed to example B of conscious philosophers who will wrestle and aim to become conscious of what they believe, why, and deal with the hard stuff that the unconscious philosopher would just say, well, come on, just have faith in God and just ignore it. So do I understand that model? Do I understand this idea?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Thanks. So if I'm missing anything, let me know.
Okay.
Thanks.
Maybe something will come to mind here, but no, I think that's right.
Okay.
I think it takes what makes philosophers is that God has given them a relatively unusual ability to access what it is that they themselves believe. Not everybody has that; it can do that readily. That's why when I read a really good philosopher, almost always a good philosopher is someone you read them and go, "I believe that. Yeah, I believe that. Yeah, I believe that. Yeah, you're damn straight. That's right." I mean, that you respond positively, not because he's telling you something you don't know, he's telling you something you already know. That's a good philosopher, I think. And why couldn't I write that book? Because I wasn't as in touch with my unconscious thoughts. And he's able to articulate and put words to things that for me are tacit and inarticulate. It's not that I don't believe them. I do, but I haven't really articulated them. Now, some of the things that I tacitly believe are false, though. And all they need to do is be articulated, and I go, that doesn't make sense. Why would I believe that? Why did I believe that? Why have I believed that? I mean, that's kind of been my career, is learning all of the things that I believed that I shouldn't have believed. You know, I mean, just...
My work in personal recovery issues has been similar. I believe that for that many years.
Yeah, exactly. So, yes, that we need to become as philosophical as we are capable of. There's another sense in which we need to be philosophical. We may not all have the same kind of ability to access our tacit and inarticulate beliefs, but when someone else accesses them, are we willing to have them challenged? And I think part of what I would mean by being a philosopher is that ruthless commitment to following truth wherever it leads, such that instead of going, I don't know how many times I've taught over the course of decades, and got the response, "Well, we don't believe that." No, we don't, do we? But the question is not whether we do. The question is whether we should, right? But I think that response, "We don't believe that," is really indicative of a much deeper problem. And that is, I'm comfortable with my inarticulate and tacit beliefs. That's me. I live there. That defines me. Don't mess with me, right? You're messing with me when you mess with my inarticulate tacit beliefs. And that it is. It's an emotionally, to go through a paradigm shift of any sort, major paradigm shift, is an emotionally wrenching experience. I mean, believe me, when I went away to college, I went through the ringer. Because they stripped everything away that I had believed in. They stripped it all away. And I had to decide what I could put back together, what I could put back in place. And I believe me, I know how psychologically, emotionally wrenching that is. But part of what we need to be committed to is not to stay comfortable, but to pursue truth. And to pursue truth means you may have to be sifted by like wheat, intellectually, philosophically sometimes. That's just part of the process. That's the cross that some of us are going to have to bear.
Well, I mean, I understand your quest, saying philosophy and so on, but sometimes I think there should be another word, because sometimes prejudice against philosophy.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's
yeah,
a great point.
And
don't get hung up on the word philosophy. Mm. If you hate philosophers, then choose another word.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I mean by it is just simply our intellectual commitments.
Mm-hmm.
To say that we have a set of philosophical assumptions is
well,
we do have a tacit set of pictures and beliefs and a tacit way of understanding the world. We just do.
Yeah. Well, you just mentioned what I was going to say. It's, I think a lot of people, instead of saying philosophy, they say worldview.
Okay.
You know? Mm-hmm. And going to your explanation of God as an author, I think it probably needs some, how can I say, clarification, because if you look at humans, like, for instance, I compose and so on, it's, you take elements that you have learned about. Like, for instance, you cannot write a novel until you learn how to write. You can't compose music until you've learned music. And I don't see that with God.
Right. So. Yeah, we are finite human creatures. So to the extent that we are capable of creation, we have a lot of catching up to do. You know, we are very limited in the processes and the results of our creative activity in a way that God is not.
Well,
and notice, for example, in the context of a novelist is working on one character at a time, in one situation at a time, has to be very linear. My assumption is that my story right now is being written simultaneously with your story right now. And God is working on billions of stories simultaneously. Well, there is no analogy to that in human experience, obviously.
So from what you said, it would seem like looking at us, you know, authors, composers, and so on, that so there's the craftsman aspect to us, since these are things that we've had to acquire and learn. Yeah, well, but I think society would kind of reject that idea. But
yeah, that's another difference between us and God. God is really creating ex nihilo in a way that we never do. I mean, we kind of simulate creation ex nihilo. I mean, we can make up in fantasy, we can make up whole other worlds. But notice those whole other worlds are strangely analogous to this world. You know, we're drawing on our experience and the things God has already created to give us material to work with for our
Yeah, that's what I said. If looking at humans with your understanding of God as author, that what humans, quote, create, is there's a craftsman aspect to that.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Jack, I have three questions.
Okay.
First one is, when you say that that your critique is against Christianity, you know, would Jesus be a Christian? Are you talking about folk Christianity, or are you talking about Christianity as it's defined by scholars, by writers, by the champions of our both
anything that today would go as Christianity, such that when they heard what I believe, mm-hmm. they would go, "You believe what? You heretic?" I mean, that's what I'm talking about. It's the creeds, the confessions, the traditions, both the spoken traditions and the unspoken traditions. Now, has Christianity got a lot of things right? Absolutely. But when you take the picture as a whole that's being proposed by any historical Christian tradition, that's what I'm saying. I don't think Jesus would buy it.
So you're not
the
talking
whole
about just anybody in the pew. You're talking about someone who would champion Christianity.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
in
absolutely.
Writing or whatever. Now, with regard to the Genesis account, the Bible says that God made Adam from the dust of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't sound like ex nihilo. So can you?
I don't think that was ex nihilo exactly.
Can you explain ex nihilo in terms of like that? I mean, God got his own dust. Is that the answer?
I'm sorry.
God got his own dust. Is that the answer?
Yeah, he created the dust before he created Adam.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the creation of Adam's body was not ex nihilo, exactly. Now, I mean, that we can argue about that. I mean, was the idea, the concept, the structure of Adam's body ex nihilo? I think I would tend to argue yes. It's not like he's looked at the dust on the ground and said, I think I see a human being there. you know, the way a sculptor sees a Michelangelo sees a statue and piece of granite or something like that. I think he's making up that concept of a man. And what about the true identity of Adam? The true identity of Adam was not exhausted by his body. There was a being there, a person there that transcended his physicality. That was a creation ex nihilo, out of nothing, I think.
My other question would be, can you give a ready example of the kinds of things that Christian writers today would say that would put them in the camp of God is on the same level as
reality? I'll get there.
Okay.
That's coming up.
I think I finally understand, although I haven't read your book, why you titled it that way,
okay.
I think. But so are you saying we're just a figment of God's imagination, that we are not real? I mean, that there is no... because an author, I mean, in what sense author and story? I've understood it in the past to be more an explanation of how God can predetermine and we act out our lives and have will. But I hadn't recognized you saying that we were merely figment of God's imagination.
Okay. I don't have any problem with calling this a figment of God's imagination, but most people would. So, you know, am I saying that we're not real? In a sense, yes. In a sense, no. But how do we hear we are not real? What we hear is, you're not as real as you thought you were. I'm not saying that. You are every bit as real as you've ever thought you are. It's just that God is way more real than you ever thought he was. He's a whole cut above us in terms of reality. And I think the right way, one of the good things Plato gave us was a much better concept of reality than we typically have. We're materialists. So when we think of whether or not something is real, we're really thinking in terms of whether it is made of stuff, whether it's concrete, whether it's tangible or not. I did an experiment once. I was driving with my kids when they were in elementary school, and I asked them, is love real? And as I had anticipated, they had a little bit of trouble answering that. It seemed funny to say no, but it seemed equally funny to them to answer yes. Because love is not something you can kick. This is real. Love is not so real, right? Love is an abstraction. You know, you can't put it in a box. You can't hide it. Well, you can hide it, but you can't put it in a box. That's a wrong conception of reality. Plato's conception of reality is, if something is vulnerable to not being, then it's not so real. But if something is not vulnerable to going out of being, now that's real. So for him, the ultimate reality, it wasn't vulnerable to going out of being. It was eternal. It was everlasting. Nothing was ever going to make it go away. So podiumness, that's real. Because I can take a blowtorch to this podium and Logan will just build another one. But who's going to take a blowtorch to podiumness? How are you going to destroy that? You can't destroy that. So Plato says that's way more real than any particular actual thing that exists in our reality. So these things aren't really very real at all. They're here this moment and gone the next. They don't have any enduring reality to them. Well, that's a better way of thinking of reality, I would argue, than our typical materialist way of thinking of reality. Love is very real. Love is much more real than the stuff of this world. The stuff of this world is going to be gone one day. That's what John says. Notice the parallel. John says, do not love the world nor the things in the world. Why? Because it's passing away. It's not here to stay. It's not here for keeps. It's only temporary. So why would you invest in that instead of investing in that which is not going to pass away, which is always going to be here, which is permanent and enduring? So he's working with something much more like the Platonic view than our modern materialist view. So are we real? Well, if God did not sustain me in existence, I'd pop out of existence. I'm actually very vulnerable to going out of existence. I need my existence to be sustained second by second, nanosecond by nanosecond, by the creator of my being. If he forgets to have me exist, I will cease to exist. So in that sense, I'm not so real. But is there anyone comparable who's sustaining God's existence? Is he vulnerable to going out of existence? If someone forgets to remember him, will he pop out of existence? I don't think so. Because I think he is existence. He is the source of existence. In fact, I would argue that's the meaning of his name, Yahweh, that Moses said, "What name shall I tell them? What name shall I attach to you?" He says, "Yahweh," which I would interpret, the Septuagint translates that, "He who is." And I think what he means by that is, I'm the one who is in a way in which you isn't. I just am. I just exist with an existence that cannot not exist. I don't have that kind of existence. I very well could not exist, but not God. So you see this gap between what it means to say that he is and what it means for me to say that I am? It's not the same thing. So in that sense, I'm less real than God. And that's exactly the relationship of an author to the works of his imagination. The works of his imagination will have existence just to the extent that the imaginer imagines that they do, and no more. But no less either. So imagine, if I were more creative, I'd have a lot of fun with this, because I'd love to write a dialogue where you have the characters discussing their relationship to the author. And one of those discussions would be whether or not we're real. Well, you can imagine characters in a novel discussing whether they're real. One of the characters is going to say, "You're ridiculous." I mean, of course we're real. We're having this conversation. I mean, how are we not real? We're as real as we think we are. But that's a different question from whether or not the author might not be more real than we are. Just because I'm real doesn't mean that God can't be more real. So I prefer to think of it as I'm real and God is more real, rather than God is real and I'm less real. But it comes to the same thing.
In the picture of an author in a story, how do the characters in the story relate to the author? I mean, I can kind of see the relationship between the author and the characters, but then how do the characters relate to the author in your picture? I mean, you were talking about a couple of characters talking to each other. How would they even know a story was being, or there was an author?
Because the author would put it in their head to conclude that.
Is that are you assuming that, or is that?
Sorry.
Are you assuming that? I mean, when I think of John Grisham.
Well, if I'm the author of the story, I would make that reality.
Right, you would, but right. Like John Grisham. But I'm thinking about John Grisham when he writes a book, uh-huh. Just picking an author, and he's writing this book full of characters. I can see his relationship to the characters. But I'm having a harder view trying to figure out how the characters would relate back to the author.
Well, they don't in a John Grisham book because he chooses to remain invisible, right? Okay. That's what's so unique about our relationship with God, is he has not chosen to remain invisible. And he's done several things. Well, he reveals himself in the story by taking up a role within the story. So Yahweh appearing to Israel and making a covenant with them and being their God and so on, is God, is the transcendent author of all of reality, actually taking up a role as if he were a character within his own story. Now, is that God himself? Yes and no. I mean, it's God, but it's God only insofar as he's revealing himself and only insofar as he's playing a role within the story. And then the most remarkable thing of all, of course, is we've just spent some time talking about Jesus, the man who God became. That's big time taking becoming a character in his story seriously. And that's what God has done. Now, could Grisham do that? He could if he wanted to, but it'd be a very different genre, you know, a very different kind of literature if he were to do that. I don't know this firsthand, but my daughter Catherine was a Spanish major, and she was looking at the literature, I don't remember that they call it, about around the time of Don Quixote in Spain. And to my knowledge, that's the only literature that's ever played with this idea of the author entering into the story. But there was a period in literature at that time where they played with that idea a little bit. But you know, for all of you creative types out there, there's a whole genre to explore. You know, I just think it could be philosophically fascinating and clarifying, frankly, very clarifying to do that. Did I answer your questions? I know. See, we're so accustomed to a model where God exists in the same plane that we do that what could be behind your question is, well, the characters aren't on the same level of reality as God is, so how can they relate to him, right? And what I'm saying is, well, not that way. You know, we're not relating to God as ontological equals, as equals in reality. Do you know what I mean by ontological? That is, the nature of my being is not the same as the nature of being of God. So I don't relate to God the same way I relate to another human being. Although evangelical culture is rife with all kinds of assumptions that God is just one more human being to be related to. And the intimacy I have with God should be like the intimacy that I have with a spouse. I was in a Bible study once where at the time, a very well-known Christian author was talking to us. And he was making the case that when we have a quiet time or a prayer time, we dare not be late. If it's rude and disrespectful to other human beings to make an appointment with them and show up late, then how much more is it disrespectful to God? And I didn't know much back then, but I knew enough to go, God doesn't know? Why is whether I'm late or not a sign of disrespect to God, who's got all the time in the world? I'm not cramping his style. I'm not keeping him from some other appointment. I'm not preventing him from doing something else if I'm late. There's no analogy. No analogy between God and other people because he's not another person. He's not finite. He's not located in space and time. He's not limited. There's all kinds of differences between him and another human being. And there's nothing wrong with recognizing that. He is the one who so transcends reality that he's not like anything in reality. As Karl Barth put it, he's wholly other. And Bart got a lot of criticism for that, but I understand what he means by that. I think he's absolutely right about that. He's completely and totally not like anything in our experience. He's the author of our experience, the author behind all of our experience. So no, we will never relate to him that way as peers. But does that mean we can't relate to him? No, we can. That's the story he's creating, is a story where we, his creation, part of his agenda is to have us know him. And how are we going to know him? He's going to script our stories and script our lives so that we come to a knowledge of the transcendent author of our being.
Yeah, Jack. I buy into the authorship portion, and I believe he is writing our story. But one thing I kind of struggle with is how, if he's given us a free will, how do we reconcile that in the story? Is it like if we did only exist in the mind of God, I could see that the story would be in progress as we live our life out, the story be written as we live that life.
Right.
And then the free will might be dealt with in that respect. But if, you know, if he foreknew us and calls us and before the foundations of the earth, that supports the authorship. But is the story, in your opinion, written before we exist or
yes,
ongoing?
Yes, and not just in my opinion. I have several verses here.
Okay. And but also, prayer and how I know, you know, prayer works on us, but is there an effect on God?
Okay. I can see already some of these questions, unfortunately, I won't get to till next week because I'm running out of time and all this stuff is coming up in my notes here. But let me respond to your question about free will to start with. I mean, yes, the whole story of everybody's story is completely scripted from beginning to end before we even come into existence. Let me read one of the passages that we'll look at briefly. I mean, I'm not going to look at any of them extensively. I was just going to read them, but this is probably as powerful as any of them. This is in Isaiah 46. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times things which have not been done and but not done yet. Saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country. Truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it. I mean, I think that's as eloquent a statement of the kind of paradigm view, understanding of God's relationship to creation as anything in the Bible. Because the relationship is God plans and purposes, and our actuality is God bringing his plans and purposes into what we call actuality, bringing it to pass. So, yes, we don't have the, if we mean by freedom, do I have the freedom to write the script of my life instead of letting the author of my being write the script of my life? No, I don't. There's no such thing as that kind of freedom. But let's take a step back. What do I mean when I say that I have free will? Well, what I should mean, I mean, granted, we have been taught, we have been trained to believe that for me to have freedom means I have autonomy, I have complete, absolute independence from God, and God can't do nothing about what I choose to do. I'm the one doing the choosing. God has no access to my chooser. And so I choose to do what I want to do, and God can't do anything about it. All he can do is come along behind me and pick up the pieces and try to fix what he can fix. But he can't, he has no access to my chooser. That's what we have been trained to mean. But what ought we to mean by saying that a human being has free will? Well, what we ought to mean is, I'm not an animal. I'm not a shark. I'm not a grizzly bear. I'm not a crocodile. I'm not a duckbill platypus. I am a human being. And what's the one distinctive difference between me, a human being, and all the other beasts in God's creations? I am a moral being. I can do good or I can do evil. none of those animals do good or evil. They just eat what's edible and spit out the rest. They're just following instinct. They're just doing what they're, these little organic robots were made to do. We don't judge them. We don't find them guilty. We might think they're dangerous, and we might destroy them because we think they're dangerous, but we don't put them on trial and convict them of a crime because they are moral creatures that ought not to have done that evil deed that they did. We never do that. But we do human beings. Why? Because we are a distinctively different kind of creation. We operate according to moral categories. We can choose good or we can choose evil. And there are things that go with that. How did God give us that kind of freedom? Unlike my animal friend, who basically is operating by physics and chemistry and biology, strangely enough, I would argue, you could never predict my next choice from the state of my biology, physics, and chemistry. I'm going to do what I'm going to do, not what my body is screaming that I do. So we always have this sense that it's never an excuse. If every cell of your body is a raging with a raging hurricane force is saying, lie, 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 I don't have to lie. Against the hurricane force of all of that, I ought to be able to stand against the hurricane force of all of my passions and desires and do what's right instead of what I want to do. We blame people for simply being like an animal, for simply following their passions, right? Or at least we ought to. Well, that's what's different. We wouldn't expect the same thing of a shark or a grizzly bear. We expect them to follow their passions, their instincts, their programming. These little organic robots are going to do what they're programming programs them to do. But not me. I can't allow myself to be reduced to an organic robot. I'm a moral being. Now, in a novel, could I create a grizzly bear alongside, let's not even make him a human being, a hobbit with a moral nature who has free will? Absolutely. This is a dragon. This is the dragon Smaug, and this is Bilbo the Hobbit. And this dragon is dangerous, but not guilty. And the hobbit can be guilty. Tolkien created him with free will. And yet his whole life is scripted by Tolkien. Right? That's the sense in which we have free will. Sure, my whole being, my whole destiny, my whole story is scripted from the very beginning of reality, but I'm not an animal. I'm a free moral agent who has a free will, and I will exercise my free will according to script. But it's a free will that's being played out and exercised, not internal programming. I'm not determined.
The free will of its script.
Well, it's not free of God, right? It's not free of the author, and it's not free of the script. But whoever told us that we're that free? You see what I'm saying? That's one of those philosophical assumptions that we inherited from our culture. But should we? Should I believe that I have that kind of freedom? Can the creature be free of the creator? Really? How do you do that? If I'm a creation, obviously it's the will of the creator who's being implemented in my creation. And I'm arguing that what we'll talk about here in a second is God, reality is not like, now this is going to date me, reality is not like a boy setting up an electric football game. You remember electric football games? You younger people have no idea what I'm talking about. It's this little football field painted metal metal plate that's made to look like a football field that vibrates electrically. And then you have little plastic football men who have little, vinyl football men who have little thin plastic stand that they sit on, and the vibration makes them move. So you set up the offense and the defense, and you turn the switch on, and you see what happens. You have absolutely no control over it. You just have to watch and see. That's the typical Christian's understanding of God's relationship to reality. He set up an electric football game. He flipped the switch, and now he's watching to see what happens. Because each of us little football players are going to do what we're going to do, and he has no control over that. Why am I saying this? What was the question?
Scripted.
Oh, how free are we? Yeah. Yeah, we're not that, we're not so free. God did not just create autonomous beings and say, okay, once I bring you into existence, I have nothing to say about what you do and who you are. And just furnish reality with us as furniture, as kind of animated furniture, and then look to see what would happen. That's the typical Christian's perspective. And I think it's fundamentally false. It's not the biblical perspective.
Well, what do you say to that? If you think about it from, you know, God created us and he gave us a spirit for us to choose right and wrong throughout our existence.
Give me a little bit more. So ask
that again. Well, this is what I'm thinking is, okay, God created me. He created all of us. And then he gave us a spirit that taught us right from wrong as we grew up, as we went through our life. And that was the portion that helped move us around to the right direction or not.
Okay.
Am I looking at that all wrong? That doesn't exist?
Well, how are you picturing the spirit? That'll help me know how to answer.
I'm picturing the spirit as God's spirit within each and every person individually, giving them direction during their life. You choose to do right or wrong by what that little voice in the back of your head says to you.
Okay. I think parts of that picture are very, very right. There's some of that picture that might be misleading. And there's a way that most Christians think about the statement that you just made that I think is very wrong. Growing up, I thought of the Spirit the way, and this is going to date me again, but you know, remember Casper the Friendly Ghost?
Yeah.
Okay. I always conceived of the Spirit as being Casper the Friendly Ghost kind of living inside of me. And we each had our own little Casper, you know, Casper Jack, who dwelt inside of me, and that was my God-given spirit, right? Something roughly like that. That's not a biblical perspective, I would argue. That probably is a Platonic perspective, which made inroads into the Christian church in Christian history big time. And so it's been a part of Christian history and tradition for a long, long time. But it doesn't come from the Bible. It comes from the pagan philosopher Plato, where he thought of the body as just a shell that was inhabited by the spirit that is the real me. Well, this actually comes back to Jason's question. I'll talk more about this next week, but let me just briefly respond this way. What is the fundamental identity of a human being? It's the role they play in a narrative. So what happens if I get thrown overboard and eaten by sharks? Do I cease to exist? Now, the way a Platonist would solve that is, well, your body got eaten up, but your spirit, you know, kind of floated to the surface and kept going. And it's fine. You know, your spirit is fine. You're just your body that got eaten up. Now, I don't think that's right. What makes me me is there is a story being told. And part of that story is having my body devoured by sharks. But just because my body is devoured by sharks doesn't mean that the fundamental identity of what makes me, me, has been lost. Because the same God who created it originally can recreate it anytime he wants to. Now, if there's a hiatus in my existence, and I actually didn't really have any actual existence in this world for a time, isn't that part of the story? That would be part of God's story for me. Is he lived this long, got eaten by sharks, and he was no more. But at the resurrection of Jesus, he, that very same one, was resurrected to eternal life in the kingdom of God. I don't have a problem with that. A materialist has a big problem with that. The materialist in us says, wait a minute, if there's some kind of discontinuity in your existence, then don't do that. But if all of this is ultimately contained in the mind and purposes of God, none of that's a threat to him. So all I'm saying is we tend to materialize spirit or soul. We tend to materialize it and make it a thing. I don't think it's a thing. I think it's an idea, a concept in the mind of the Creator. And it's actually more secure there than it is if it's a thing in the world. Because if it's an idea and a concept in the mind of the Creator, nobody can touch it. Nobody, rust can't rust it, and moth can't eat it, and thieves can't break in and steal it. It's totally secure. Okay, I guess I better let you go. I didn't get as far as I want. We'll just continue this next Sunday, right from here.